Well, good afternoon again, everyone, and welcome back to the second annual Evercore ISI CCUS Summit. Again, I'm James West. I run Sustainable Technologies and Clean Energy for Evercore ISI. We're very excited to have both Core Labs and Talos Energy with us today. Speaking from Talos is Robin Felder, who she's the Executive Vice President, Low Carbon Strategy and Chief Sustainability Officer, leading Talos's Energy's carbon capture and sequestration business and oversees the company's ESG initiatives. Prior, Robin served as president, CEO, and director of Noble Midstream Partners, where she guided the partnership in Chevron and led the transaction of Noble Midstream following the Noble Energy acquisition. Before Noble, Robin served as CEO, president, and director for Western Midstream Partners, leading the Western Anadarko Petroleum Corporation market organizations through the 2019 Occidental acquisition. And within her 20 years in Anadarko, Robin served as VP of Investor Relations, along with other E&P roles. With us from Core Labs is Larry Bruno, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer since 2020, and President and Chief Operating Officer since 2018. Larry also ran Core Labs Petroleum Services Division within the Reservoir Description segment and was General Manager of the U.S. Rocks business from 1999 to 2015, with a Master's degree in Science and Geology. From the University of Houston, he began his career at an oil and gas service company before it was acquired by Core Labs. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here, James.
Great. Well, guys, I believe you have a presentation you wanted to quick hit on, and then I think Core, you guys have an animation?
Yeah, I've got a quick one here that hopefully will kind of help frame up the big picture for those that might be beginning to delve into the topic here. Let's see if that's got it. Yeah, I think there we go. So with any carbon capture and storage project, there's going to be a lot of money spent, and most of the money is going to be spent at what would be the upstream. So catching the CO2 at the point of creation, at the point of combustion, if you will, and then gathering that and eventually transporting that to the site of injection. So that's where most of the money is going to get spent. But most of the risk in a project is in getting the subsurface injection target model wrong. And that's where Core Lab comes in. And so there are three major buckets, I would say, of CO2 subsurface injection or sequestration projects. One is for enhanced oil recovery, and that's been going on for a long time. CO2 turns out to be a very effective solvent that will help mobilize oil in many reservoirs, not all, certainly, but many oil and gas reservoirs, or mostly oil reservoirs. And so there would probably have been a lot more enhanced oil recovery projects on the planet if there was a more reliable and volume availability of CO2. And now with regulations pushing that, there'll probably be more CO2 injections for enhanced oil recovery. And then there's saline aquifers, and these would be non-oil and gas bearing strata that have brines of some type in them. And then finally, some companies are also looking at depleted oil and gas reservoirs. That is, they've created accommodation space by producing oil and gas from those for decades or longer, and now they can use that accommodation space to accept some of that CO2. So where Core Lab's role comes in here is we understand and can help our clients understand reactivity with the rock and rocks and fluids and the fluids and the fluids, how is the CO2 going to react with the pore fluids. We can also help them understand the storage capacity of the injection target. One of the big risks in a project like this is you think you might have 30 or 40 years or many decades of injection storage capacity. If you get that wrong, the project can be financially challenged. And then the seal capacity is very important. If you're going to inject CO2 into the ground, it's got to be contained. And so what is the seal capacity of those rocks? And then the understanding the peculiarities of each target injection zone. So just a quick graphic here to reinforce those three topics. One is for enhanced oil recovery. In those cases, CO2 will be injected into existing fields. And then oil, as well as some enriched with CO2, will get produced out of producing wells. You'll have injector wells and producer wells. And so that oil gets forced to the surface in a cyclical process. Another would be into depleted oil reservoirs. And here we've got one that's been produced for a long time. In this case, we're not trying to produce any more oil and gas. We're just saying, hey, I've got space. I can fill this space up with CO2 and put that CO2 in the subsurface and park it. One of the advantages of those is you generally know pretty well about the seal of the formation. It held the hydrocarbons back, the oil and natural gas, over time, and that can be an effective seal. One of the downsides to using these is if you've got a lot of penetrations in an area, you might have a leak in the seal from man-made penetrations through the seal and into the target zone. And then finally, I think what's probably driving most of the attention today, and I think where some of the biggest opportunities are in these saline aquifers. So non-oil and gas bearing strata, where a well will be drilled for the sole objective of having identified a structure and an accommodative stratigraphic target, the CO2 gets put in the ground and gets sequestered there by the geologic strata that encapsulates it. Now, I've glossed over a lot of the details there, but we'll probably get a chance to get into some of those. Okay, so let me see if I can stop that share. There you go.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, everybody. So I have a ton of questions. So I'll go ahead, but just for the audience, just a reminder that we do have a Q&A box, so please feel free to submit your questions in there. If you have any questions for the team here, I wanted to start a little bit with collaboration. And Robert, congrats on your most recent announcement. Although, I'm sorry, Robert, did you have a presentation to go through as well?
I have a few high-level slides. Larry did a great job.
I'm sorry. I went right to my Q&A. Sorry, go ahead.
No worries. I got the share screen ready to go. So I will just very briefly just touch on kind of how Talos is focused in this space to try to help frame it up a little bit, see if I can get into it. All good on the screen sharing? You guys can see that okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Good. So you know, Talos is an exploration production company, actually celebrating 10 years this year, been public for about 4 of those last 10 years, but got started in and around the Gulf Coast and has over time continue to step out into the deeper water, chasing the larger hydrocarbon structures, the higher wells, higher rate wells with more of a liquids focus. So it's a little bit different when we're thinking about CCS opportunities. We have world-class storage capabilities here when we think about the rock. Larry mentioned saline aquifers, and that's what we will be targeting in our carbon capture and sequestration projects. But we've also got a really good expertise and knowledge of the subsurface here, and that's the other key components. I'll touch on here, and you'll hear this theme, I'm sure, throughout our panel today. There's a lot of partnerships that need to take place and collaboration that's going to help us really jumpstart this new subsector and to get these projects up and running. So just kind of as we alluded to, when you start thinking about the subsurface, it sounds and looks a lot like upstream when you think about exploration production companies as far as what skill sets and expertise we're using to tackle this. But really having a good working knowledge of the rock in this area, being able to model it, being able to predict where that CO2 plume will migrate over time, and really just for that operational assurance of being a deep water operator, it's important that we can do things in a very ESG-focused and responsible manner. And so I think folks are looking for us to demonstrate that and help lead the way here. So just another visual on the value chain. I really liked the 3D animation. I think that helps bring it to bear. But as we think about it, you know, the capture side, we're doing this as a service for large industrials. So whether they're going to install that capture equipment themselves, as mentioned, very costly, or we can help in that process, it's a big decision to do that. And so we'll be coming to our new customer base, offering this as a solution where we can transport through some new or existing infrastructure to our sequestration site. So basically drilling an injection well, injecting, and then monitoring that CO2 plume over time. But we've got to get all that validated. That way, We can prove back for our Class 6 permit, which is a big part of the sequestration process, but also so our customer or perhaps ourselves can claim the tax credit to help get some funding back in to help with these investments that, again, are very expensive when you're talking about retrofitting existing infrastructure. So today, Talos has four different announced projects along the U.S. Gulf Coast. We've got a combination of some very bespoke point source solutions like we have for Freeport LNG, where we have a single customer we're servicing, and then several of these very large regional hubs where we're really tackling and trying to create a new solution for a myriad of different large industrials in these industrial corridors and put together not just the store, the subsurface where we'll do the sequestration, but also infrastructure network on how we're going to gather and transport it. And so that's where you've seen us in some cases partner with midstream providers that have a footprint in the region very strategically. And so as we think about developing these projects, we're looking for all the right ingredients. In some cases, we might even be bringing in, like we just announced last week in Bayou Bend, Chevron's proposing to come into our partnership there with our partner CarbonVert. And it's really to help us learn and lead and develop this project together. We will continue to be the operator, but as they're doing CCS projects around the globe, we can really be a fast learner and implement some of those best practices as we go. And so kind of just wrapping up on, again, you'll hear this theme a lot. It's a lot of collaboration, partnerships. You saw some of our different partners we've got there, both in our equity on the projects themselves, but also technically as this is a slightly different space. Yes, we've done CO2 and enhanced oil recovery for decades, but doing this at scale in saline aquifers, it's just a little bit different. And we recognize that we need to de-risk what's going on in the subsurface as much as we can. So that's where it's great to partner with CoreLab here and their expertise and what they can help us do. As we drill some of these early stratigraphy wells and apply for these Class 6 sequestration permits that are a critical path item for our projects. And then lots of advocacy as well, making sure we're kind of educating as we go. It's a new space, so there's lots of questions, but also trying to get policy in place that'll be supportive of these new projects.
Right.
And so we've got Talos Low Carbon Solutions, building out this decarbonization platform, starting with CCS, but looking beyond as we continue to grow along the Gulf Coast, advance our projects, and then look outside to the broader value chain. So this is kind of who we are.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for that, Robin. I appreciate it. And sorry, I almost skipped over you there. So maybe just to start, you mentioned the Chevron New Energies has joined the Bayou Bend hub development and talk a little about collaboration, how important that is. You know, what does Chevron bring to the table for this project? Are there opportunities for you guys to collaborate on further CCS projects?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we're looking across, we're looking at who are those strategic partners when you think about the value chain. I talked about the natural fit of some of these midstream providers that have a footprint in the region. They have existing, not just pipe in the ground, but right of way. So even if you have to build some new pipe, at least you have a good starting point. And in some cases, tied into some of these customers, when you think about where that last mile of pipe is, they already have some of those relationships. And so as we think about underwriting a large scale regional hub, we're looking at who are those other strategic partners. In some cases, if you've got somebody who can bring anchoring emissions, kind of like you anchor or underwrite a pipeline or a gas processing plant, those folks might want to come in and perhaps they part of the requirement is to participate and learn as well. So we'll be considering that as we develop these hubs and trying to find those folks that can bring either some good assets to the mix or perhaps some expertise, or just so we can learn together as folks are looking at projects around the globe. So we'll continue to evaluate those strategic partnerships and certainly on the technical alliance side too, where we can try to have the greater learning and advance these projects quickly.
Sure, absolutely. And maybe to Larry then, obviously we see how you kind of fit into this alliance. Have you been doing work already? Is this project already started for you guys?
So yeah, so the Talos folks at CoreLab have a great history of working together, great collaboration. Talos is kind of a perfect client for us in that they're a data-driven analytical company that builds their understanding on hard measurements. And that's, so we've been doing that with Talos on the oil and gas side for quite some time. So a real nice fit there. Currently where we are in with the Talos projects is just, we're in the planning and collaboration stages to get ready for the first taste, if you will, of the rocks and the fluids that are, have to be assessed. And that means looking at the seal rock, looking at the target zone or zones, and also looking at the fluids. CO2 is a reactive molecule. If you put it into water, it will make that brine or that water more acidic, and that may react with the rock. It could also cause scale to develop. So we're preparing to make sure we've got those things covered. With every type of subsurface evaluation, whether it's traditional oil and gas or whether it's a CCS project, there's an inherent discovery process that goes on once the core and the fluids are captured from the formation. And then that'll guide the more details of the analytical program as we go. But right now, getting ready to establish protocols, what we're going to test early on, how we're going to deliver that, those results, and the timelines for those to make sure that we become a force for moving things along rather than any type of a hindrance on the project advancement.
Got it. Okay. And you also announced a CCS consortium. I know you have the six inaugural member companies, which includes Talos. You know, how do you decide where subsurface rock, which subsurface rock you want to study? Do you need to build a library of global subsurface carbon sequestration opportunities? How is this consortium going to be to play out?
Yeah. So the point of the consortium was to look at how to evaluate CCS targets. So you mentioned Talos, Chevron's in it, Repsol, EOG, JX Nippon, and Shell all participating in it. And they're all trying to figure out what are the steps we need to go through to understand the process of doing the subsurface evaluation to feed into, for the U.S., to feed into those permit requirements that are out there. And so, yeah, you can think of it as a library, but maybe also think of it as a framework for ranking and comparing various CCS target opportunities. Just like an oil and gas reservoir, the rocks and the fluids are going to determine how productive or more productive or less productive they are. Well, same thing here. The variables in the rocks and the fluids need to be evaluated and ranked or compared and say, hey, this looks like a better opportunity, or given these three opportunities, here's my best opportunity. That's where I'll put my capital.
Right. Okay. And then, Robin, I know you guys have targeted this year, at least your budget, 5% of your CapEx will be for CCS, which you, I think, have highlighted as kind of a building block, because you expect that to normalize to 50-50 over time. With these initial investments, they include, you know, stratigraphic well tests, feed work, obviously, class six permitting, additional lease acquisitions. I guess, first, just for my knowledge, what is a stratigraphic well test? And then all these things, can you perform all this with existing oil and gas technologies?
Okay, so the stratigraphic well test, it's really just drilling a well so we can collect some data to better understand and characterize the subsurface. So again, great to be partnered up here with Core Lab to help us do some of that work. It's key not just for, so we understand the reservoir, how that's going to work when we actually start injecting, but also for these class six permits. So part of these EPA issued class six sequestration permits is this long-term monitoring and verification plan. So they want you to demonstrate and to show to them how you're going to basically show that CO2 is still being permanently stored within the rock. And so we can develop a model based on existing seismic in the area, existing wells, but until you get some good core or other data collected in addition, where you're going to be injecting and perhaps even monitoring, it's hard to say. And you know, so the more information we have, the better we can characterize that rock and have a pretty good predictor. So then once we actually start injecting and we have all this monitoring going on, we can history match and make sure we've got a really valid model. So that was the first part of it. The second part is, you know, what other technologies are needed. So we certainly have a lot of capability when it comes to building out a reservoir model in the subsurface and you know, injecting, pressuring up wells, even developing infrastructure projects and doing project execution. That's all in oil and gas skill set and expertise. What's different, it will be some of this monitoring piece, so making sure that we've got everything in place as far as how we're doing the verification. As we think about a carbon accounting and how that's going to be working, where right. you know, this molecule coming from this emitter is now going into this injection well and is still being permanently stored here, we're going to have to validate that back, especially if our customer is trying to claim a IRS tax credit, right? They want that incentive to help with their capital outlay for their investment. So that'll be important for us to develop some of these carbon accounting platforms, maybe even leveraging some blockchain technology just to be able to show you've got really secure transactions when you think about that ledger and how we're moving different molecules around.
Interesting. And for when you're permitting, class six well, is that same or is it different from permitting a traditional oil and gas well?
So usually if you're permitting an oil and gas well, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, if you're in the state of Texas, the state of Louisiana, or in the federal waters, you're going through different agencies. For class six, that's all going through EPA for these states. There are a few states in the U.S. that have applied for and been granted primacy. So the state regulatory body does that. But both for Texas and Louisiana, in which our projects reside, it's still at the EPA. So Louisiana has filed for primacy, and we're hearing Texas is not too far behind, in hopes that respectively the Louisiana Department of Natural Resource would be the regulatory body overseeing that, and the Texas Railroad Commission. And we think that's encouraging because we know those are well-staffed agencies. They're very familiar with our type of operations. And in fact, permit and monitor today saltwater disposal wells, for example, sure. It's a very similar approach. So we know that they've got the resources to do that, and we're just concerned about timeline, right? It's just making sure we can move all this, as it's not just us, but we have lots of peers in this space filing these applications and trying to get these projects online.
Right, right. And is it possible to repurpose existing or wells that you've depleted, oil and gas wells, to do sequestration?
Yeah, it's certainly feasible. We can repurpose pipe and do as much, but you know, our approach is instead of going into old depleted reservoirs, we're looking for these clean, very very large rock columns, very big containers for our storage sites. That's why we've chosen these saline aquifers. We're not dealing with a depleted pressure situation. And we will be building new infrastructure, including the injection wells themselves. And part of that is just the nature of these agreements. We're setting these leases up to be very long-term leases, 20, 30 years in length, and so will some of this offtake, if you think of it in that sense, as we're taking on emissions from our customers sure. and putting it away for a long time. So just, we want to make sure we're designing everything with that in mind for the longevity and right. we've got it spec'd in up front.
We have a couple of questions from Juan kind of around that same, what you ended on there. Have you estimated the cost to monitor these class four injection wells, you know, after the injection has ceased according to EPA guidelines? And how do you think about protecting the company from the financial responsibilities of a CO2 leak?
Yeah, so we are taking on that liability. That's something that as the person doing the sequestration, we certainly have to consider that, just like we have insurance products to be a deep water operator. There are insurance products being developed in this space for CCS. And so that is something we'll certainly need to have, because to your point, we will want to verify back to our customer it's still being preserved and in place. So I mean, if you think about oil and gas development, we're pulling out resources that have been in the rock for millions of years. So we're reversing that and drilling into these saline aquifers that are on the order of 4,000 to 8,000 feet in depth, so a mile into the ground. And so we feel like we've got some good ability to contain that. And so it's important for us that we have and understand these models, and it'll include some seismic data. So as we think about the verification and monitoring piece, we can do a combination of in-zone monitoring wells with some permanent gauges, just top of zone, and some different seismic products, whether it, you know, maybe some snapshot in time views. The good news is the CO2 will light up on a seismic sheet. You can really see where it's migrating over time.
And how do you guys think about the economics of that sequestration in terms of kind of the storage fee and how long you're going to sequester it? I mean, how do you work out the financial agreement with the emitter?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's one of the most common ones of, you know, how do you make money?
Sure. With this?
And again, we're approaching it as CCS as a service. So we are providing a service for transportation and injection and can deliver back basically verification that that's being permanently sequestered. And so we're looking at this as like a tolling model. So a long-term agreement here for this service. So it's very much more of a midstream model than an upstream model. We're not talking about depleting assets like we have in BP. We're talking about almost an inclining stream, volumes coming in as we bring on customers or perhaps even new greenfield investment and development that has built-in capture there so we can immediately sequester it. That's what's really advantageous. And that's when the economics really start to kick in is as you can get some of those new greenfield volumes.
Right. And I know we're early days with CCS, but we have been doing this for EOR and stuff. And companies have been able to get, you know, 45Q tax credits, as you were alluding to earlier. What happens if the sequestration is not permanent? If you do have a leak, is there a clawback mechanism? Like, what if something goes wrong? I guess
there is inside the tax code, right? They want to make sure that it's still being stored. So for it's called recapture. So if it's not, there is a clawback for that tax credit. Just like if you go and change your taxes each year, can get audited, and so that's where that carbon accounting and all that verification is very important for us, and that's where having the good technical work in the subsurface and having a great model to start off with is key for that.
Gotcha. Okay. And I know that you're in the initial process phase here now, but how do you think about cycle times? And I'm assuming you can expect these cycle times to contract as you build out more and more of these facilities.
So we had some dates on the one slide I show. I mean, pretty aggressive. We're looking at for, you know, single point source, single customer solution. We can do that in around a 3-year time frame to get to first injection for these regional hubs, depending on the infrastructure. And again, it's very scalable, probably 4+ years. And it's just ideally we can stack the emissions on top of the store. So you have minimal transportation needs. It helps keep the cost low. And so we can offer a competitive fee for service for our customer base. But in some cases, we're taking it to our offshore state waters lease that we have offshore Jefferson County, Texas, and our Bayou Bend project. We will need some incremental infrastructure there. So it's important that we get that planned out. But also and make it where we can loop it and scale it over time as additional emissions start coming into the system, even as I mentioned, for some new investment in these industrial corridors.
And how do you think about when you're underwriting these projects to make sure you effectively, you know, get good economics and get a return? Do you have a price of carbon that you think about? Do you have a tax credit change in mind, or using current market conditions and holding those flat? I mean, how does that process work?
So it depends. And some of our customers, again, we're thinking about this as a fee for service. So we can run sensitivities on different fees and different volumes over time and get this infrastructure like model where we can see how the economics work there. Again, not upstream returns. This is going to be more like midstream infrastructure returns, but very long lived. You know, that said, there are some opportunities where we can do a whole end-to-end solution and in some cases actually do the capture work. So for Freeport LNG, for example, that customer has said, you know, if you can come in and do the capture and the transport and sequestration for us, that would be great. And since it's kind of all on site, very limited transport needs, they've got additional acreage surrounding their facility. So we can basically inject in and around their fence line. For a competitive cost that can work inside the credit. And so we can claim the tax credit and start exploring ways to, if we're not going to take that credit ourselves, to put it into a tax equity vehicle. If direct pay gets put into the tax code, we could transfer that. And even starting to think about the carbon markets, the voluntary markets where folks are selling some of these offsets. So whether we want to claim that towards Talos emissions or monetize that in a different form, we've got a lot of different options.
Right, right. And Larry, where along the project timeline, which different, you're upfront, you're doing the upfront work, but I believe you come back in some of the monitoring phases. Is that correct?
Yeah, so over time, so you're right, we'll start off with the stratigraphic evaluation and the fluid interaction, the fluid reactivity. There'll also be opportunities for Core Lab using its expertise in well completions and well perforations. You have to create communication between the injection well and the formation. So our perforating projects come into play. And then also within our value chain here, we've got the opportunity to test quantity and quality. People are going to need to validate, is this pure CO2? Has it been diluted with 8% nitrogen from the atmosphere? That's all going to have to be measured, and then the quantities of that. So we have a role to play in that as well. So very early on, and then over the life of the project.
Okay, great. Samantha, I've been taking up all the questions. I want to leave time for you as well.
Yeah, no. You know, one thing that's been top of mind, and it kind of came up in one of the earlier sessions, was just that in North Dakota, they reclaimed the wells after 10 years. I was wondering if that's something similarly being contemplated in Texas and Louisiana.
Well, in many cases, I alluded to on the leases, they're very long-lived leases. So what our intent is, we'll identify a storage site, we'll have injection wells and associated monitoring wells. And once you'll have the injection period, you'll have the monitoring timeline. And then at some point you get to a closure, meaning you're kind of closing the store out. You've pressured up and you feel like you've filled that space within the area of the pore space you've leased. And so then it will revert back to, in the case of Bayou Bend, back to the state. And so these projects do have lives to them, although I will say we're talking several decades. And so when you get to that point, yes, then you can certainly, you know, plug and abandon a well, just like we would a producing well.
Let's see. So another question that I had was just, you know, in terms of the economics with all the inflation that we're seeing with steel costs and just the global supply chain, I'm assuming on the projects that you're executing, you're already well ahead of the curve in terms of ordering everything that you need.
Yeah, we're starting to order some long leads now for that very reason, not just for cost, which we've seen the cost of some steel components, especially when thinking about chrome for CO2 and the nickel that goes into making chrome. But just from supply constraints. So trying to get out and pre-order some wellheads, for example, for that we can use and plug into different projects. So the more we can try to standardize some of that where we have a very similar wellhead, we're looking for a dry tree, even in our offshore project. And then the other three are onshore. So if we can, you know, design one and build many, we'll try to leverage that too to keep our costs down and to help with sourcing through supply chain crunches.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other thing that I'm thinking about also is once it's up and running in terms of the operating, is it going to be mostly remote? Do you need people to send out people out in the field and inspect? You know, how should we think in terms of applying digital technologies into the day-to-day operations?
Now, that's a great question. I think even like similar to the offshore where, you know, we try to thinly man these facilities and we'll have crews off and on. But as you get into true injection operations, just like a producing well, you can have periodic checks, but a lot of it is digitally controlled these days. You can have operations control centers. And so and it's great on keeping costs down and also looking at your additional environmental footprint if you're not having to get people and resources out to those wellheads as frequently. Obviously, that's good from an ESG standpoint, including safety, just, you know, keeping people from being behind the wheel and having to drive out all the time. So yeah, we'll be able to leverage that. Even I mentioned the permanent gauges when we think about the monitoring. So you'll have some of that installed and we can do a lot of this remotely. And even on some of the completions that Larry mentioned, where if you're recompleting up a wellbore, you can do a lot of that remotely where you don't have to have physical intervention each time. You know, we will have some workforce needs as we're doing new construction and building out pipe, for instance. So good jobs creation on that front as far as giving some folks some onshore work in the infrastructure space. But once you get into operational mode, it's fairly limited, which I think is good when you're thinking about building out a decarbonization solution. You want to do that in a very environmentally and ESG focused manner.
Another thing that kind of jumps to mind is just, you know, are you seeing an interest in more pilot studies? I'm just kind of wondering if, you know, that's a result of the Russia-Ukraine war, if you've just seen a, you know, like a surge in interest or just an increase in customer discussions.
I'll be interested to hear from Larry on this as well. You know, there's so much going on right now, including the Ukraine invasion, that it's hard to point to what it is, but I definitely say interest has expanded very rapidly. A lot of folks are wanting to not just see how they can play it, but really truly participate in an energy transition and bring that into their portfolios, not just through some of these venture funds, but actually going out and owning equity in these projects or are serving as a solution provider for some of these new ideas. So it's exciting. There's lots of folks that want to invest in this space as well. We've seen a lot of funds raised. So whether it's somebody wanting to work with us, work for us, be our customer or invest, there's lots of interest, and I'd say it's growing. So, you know, the conflict internationally surely plays a part into when you think about the need to have decarbonization solutions and a true energy transition play here. But it also shows the near-term need for ESG-friendly oil and gas production. So, that's where the Talos proposal or investment thesis can really kind of present both of those. So it's exciting. But yeah, I'll see if Larry has any comments. It's been interesting these past several months.
Yeah, Robin, I think seeing very similar, you are a lot of interest in the area. So we've had a couple of projects that we've been able to talk publicly about going on over the last, say, year and a half or so. One is in Southeastern Australia, the Carbon Net Project, where they're trying to do similar type of evaluation. What is the gathering going to look like? What is the transportation going to look like? And then very importantly, where we come in, what is the subsurface risks, and how do we get hard data points so that we can develop a model that's been de-risked as much as possible? I think it's an interesting change here in that when we get over the past, say, dozen years or so, a point source emitter might approach us about wanting to see about doing some type of injection well, whether it was CO2 or a combination of CO2 bearing fluids. What's changed for us in the last, say, 2 years is that our traditional oil and gas upstream clients are now jumping into the arena. And quite frankly, I don't know how you do a project like this without somebody that has the expertise that a highly talented oil and gas company has. I can't imagine the folks trying to drill and complete wells and build a reservoir model if you haven't done that on the upstream E&P side. So a company like Talos, perfectly set up with their expertise, things that we don't do, stuff like seismic and evaluating structures in the subsurface, how faulted or unfaulted it might be. That's gonna have to draw on E&P company experience. They really are the best ones to do this.
We do have a question from the line. I think this is probably an EPA issue, but the question is it possible not to engage in separation and just take flue gas straight to the aquifer?
Well, there's a couple things there. Obviously, yeah, if you're trying to claim a CO2 removal credit, whether it's for tax purposes or in the voluntary market, you're going to need to show how much of that is CO2. The other thing is when you think about any kind of infrastructure, whether it's the gathering lines themselves, the pipeline, or even when you think about wellbore construction, you have certain specs, right? You're trying to design to, right. So you've got the right metallurgy for a certain percentage of CO2, hopefully dehydrated to get all the water out of it. and remove a lot of those particulates and other factors in there. That way you've got integrity in your systems. So that's one of the big reasons you want to make sure you not only know what's going in, but you've got, you're designing to a certain specification.
Right, right. Okay. Well, I think that's it for me. Samantha, do you have any last ones for Larry and Robin while we have them?
Just one more. You know, the LNG space, I think, is really fascinating in terms of how demand has just really, you know, increased a lot in recent months. And I think the outlook is so strong. Could we expect to see, you know, LNG, like carbon capture, to be part of the LNG structure going forward, just to see more of those where it's like a self-containing, you know, cyclical system like that, like what you're building for Freeport?
Yeah, and I think you could even see it in new builds where it's kind of built in, where you're capturing. I mean, the pre-combustion CO2 is pretty straightforward, right? They're trying to already separate out to a very pure natural gas stream before they liquefact it and ship it. But even when you think about the end user and it's going and saying a natural gas fired plant, having a CCS solution on that end. What's interesting too is, you know, we've got a lot of natural gas resources here in the United States and fairly lower cost feedstock. I know it's been higher as of recent, but hopefully as we get into a better equilibrium of supply and demand globally, we'll see that we have lots of low cost natural gas feedstock for all these blue technologies that we're thinking about making blue hydrogen, blue ammonia. If we already have CCS in place, that can enable those new investments where you're creating these zero emissions fuel sources leveraging natural gas, but also you've got the CCS to remove the emissions associated with in the process of making it. And so you've got a relatively green system there. So I think that's, we'll see more of that as well as demand for these clean burning fuels increases over time.
Great, thanks. James, that does it for me.
Well, great. Well, Robin, Larry, thanks so much for your time today. This was very illuminating. Congrats on your success here. And we look forward to catching up again soon.
Thanks, James. Thanks, Samantha.
Thanks, guys.
Guys.
Thanks for hosting.